Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, can worker-owned cooperatives transform workers' lives and livelihoods? Then we'll talk about the politics of official apologies. How important are these apologies and what impact might they make? But first, we'll revisit the 1926 founding of Black History Month and the pivotal civil rights campaign in Birmingham. Has Black History Month had its intended impact? V.P. Franklin is with us. He is a distinguished professor of history at University of California, Riverside. He's also the editor of the Journal of African American History, which was founded by Carter G. Woodson. And he's the author of several books, including The Education of Black Philadelphia, The Social and Educational History of a Minority Community, Black Self-Determination, A Cultural History of African American Resistance, and Living Our Stories, Telling Our Truths, Autobiography, and the Making of the African American Intellectual Tradition. Welcome, V.P. Franklin.
Good to be on here.
Great to have you here with us. I want to start with Black History Month and its importance in American history. Has Black History Month had its intended impact?
I think that considering where people began in terms of trying to remember African and African American past, when they started with Negro History Week back in 1926, I doubt that they would have thought that the entire nation would be celebrating a month that was devoted to African-American history. Carter G. Woodson and the founders of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History wanted to make the record clear and accurate and bring forth evidence to try to deal with the various negative portrayals of people of African descent that were abundant throughout U.S. society and popular culture, and they wanted to challenge those representations, and they put forward the Journal of Negro History and then Negro History Week and the Negro History Bulletin, which became the Black History Bulletin, to tell another story, to tell the African-American story, and to deal with distortions and other misrepresentations that were out there in the public.
Do we still have a long ways to go?
In terms of the people who originally started, I think that they will think that we have come quite far with the television shows and the documentaries and the proclamation. I think that they will think that we have come very far. But we have known more about the past, but we have not necessarily learned all the lessons that we need to learn from the past. And I think that the more time that we spend trying to investigate the past and see how it relates to the present, it may help us to decide on and how to figure out how to deal with the future.
Well, let's look at some of the past issues then. The Birmingham Civil Rights Movement, a movement credited by many to have really changed the course of not just U.S. history, but other histories of oppressed people. Why don't you remind us what happened in Birmingham?
The Birmingham campaign had been launched against police and the sheriff company of Bull Connor for many years before 1963. There had been clashes between the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Birmingham Police Force. And remember, it was under Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who had been leading the campaign to try to desegregate public facilities in Birmingham before, all the way up to 1963. And these confrontations had been going on for quite a while. But it was a matter of whether or not the civil rights forces would decide to target Birmingham, and because of its intransigence, and to actually use that as a way of defining what it actually is that they want out of this movement and the forces that are against it. Very clearly, in real life, this confrontation had to take place because this is what they wanted, and it did, and to some extent, many people paid a very high price for their participation in that Birmingham campaign, the four girls that were killed in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, and then all the people that were fired from their jobs as a result of having been arrested during the protests. And so they paid very dearly for this, but they made it clear what they wanted, and ultimately, a lot of people paid a heavy price, but ultimately they were able to get the president to send the civil rights bill to Congress in June of 1963, and then were able to mobilize 200,000 people to come to the march on Washington in August of 1963 to support the passage of the bill and also to support organized labor and working people's rights.
Now, you mentioned the young girls that died in the bombing, but there were quite a few others as well.
Yes, yes. And the Children Crusades has come to to be defined as that period when the children and the teenagers in Birmingham saw what was happening to their parents and the involvement that their parents were in these campaigns, and that many of them had already gone to jail for this cause. You know, they said that, well, we're willing to make that sacrifice. We're willing to participate as well, because they understood what it was that their parents and their community was doing. They came to understand that they were doing the right thing and that this was important to them as children. To them, you know, this was important to me because it's important to them. They then decided that they were going to fill in where their holes in the lines, you know, in terms of representation in the protests by adults. So we have all of these graphic images now that were preserved of the children being hosed and attacked by dogs and placed in police cars and paddy wagons. So we have those images that are there, and they demonstrate the commitment of the children of Birmingham. But children throughout the civil rights movement participated in various campaigns. Children took a stand, mobilized, and participated in civil rights activism.
The other group that you have also written about that were very engaged were the African American women. And we know a lot about Rosa Parks, but there were others. Tell us about some of the key women within these movements, such as Ella Baker or Mary McLeod Bethune.
Mary McLeod Bethune was active in the 1930s and 1940s and, you know, died in 1955. And she was the head of the National Council of Negro Women and was the leading black figure and educator for her entire, almost a generation in terms of her importance and influence. But the way that we have been trying to document these women's participation and leadership of these various civil rights campaigns is by having the women tell their stories and find as many of these women as possible and have them tell their stories about their involvement, and then we record it and then make it available, and then it can become an oral history and an oral testimony that can be used when historians are telling the stories about those campaigns. They'll be able to interweave, you know, the individual women's stories. And so most recently, you had the women in SNCC who decided to write about their stories. And now this is a book that came out in 2011, Hands on the Freedom File, and where these women, and this is like 50 women, wrote about their experiences in SNCC. And so what we have been doing is making sure that the women who were active in Mississippi and still are in Mississippi get to tell their story, and the women in Alabama who were active in various civil rights campaigns to tell their stories. In other words, we've gone beyond the leaders, and we're now getting the stories of the participants and to try to understand why average, ordinary people decided that they would be willing to put themselves on the line. And the reality is that the African-American women and their social and religious network was really the basis upon which the church aspects of the movement was held together. When you say that the civil rights movement developed in and around the black church, then who was the most important influence in the black church? Okay, the ministers, yes, the ministers and stuff, but also the women and the women's organizations. And ultimately, you find that it is the women that actually sustain these campaigns and sustain these leaders. You have the prize-winning book by Betty Collier Thomas, Jesus, Jobs, and Justice, African-American Women and Religion, deals specifically and in detail with the participation of women, religious women, and their church groups in these various civil rights campaigns and protests. And ultimately, they sustained them. They sustained them so that they could be successful.
If you were going to assess where we need to go from here, both for advancement of equality and also for advancement of race relations, what would you say?
There are all kinds of new opportunities that have come with Barack Obama's second term. And I think that one way that people can come together is to try to deal with the problems that exist in terms of the violence that exist in the society, and particularly that's affecting the children, and the problem of the incarceration, and the problem of the high dropout rates. And so people can recognize that those are the problems, that exist, and there's a need to do something about them, and they should be willing to accept something new to try to address this problem. For example, in the Journal of African American History, I discussed the creation of a reparations superfund and call on the NAACP to convene a meeting to establish an organization that would oversee this reparations superfund. And then just as people who were damaged by the BP spill went to the superfund and made claims, then people who are interested in dealing with the problem of violence and dropping out and all of these things and have programs that work would be able to appeal to this reparations superfund as well. And so that we would move beyond, we would say, okay, there are ways and programs out there to fight this, and many of them don't have enough money not only to expand, but not enough money to exist. And the banks and the financial institutions have already said that they have damaged people, and particularly African Americans, up to $25 billion worth, then they need to be depositing some of that money into a reparations superfund so we can do something about the violence and the killing that's going on in Chicago and Philadelphia and all of these cities. And I hope that the NAACP understands that we need to do something to try to deal with these problems.
VP Franklin, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
VP Franklin is Distinguished Professor of History at the University of California at Riverside. He is the editor of the Journal of African American History that was founded by Carter Woodson and is the author of several books, including The Education of Black Philadelphia, The Social and Educational History of a Minority Community, Black Self-Determination, A Cultural History of African American Resistance, and Living Our Stories, Telling Our Truths, Autobiography in the Making of African American Intellectual Tradition. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. And here is This Week in History with Spencer Downing.
African American History Month began in 1926, the brainchild of the historian Carter G. Woodson. Countless comedians have joked that we devote the year's shortest month to black history, but it actually represents a step forward. Woodson originally called for just a week, noting that both Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass had been born in February. As he saw it, at least some time set aside for considering African American history would augment a larger process of demanding and developing greater respect and more opportunity. Carter Woodson himself was virtually a self-made man, in many ways the epitome of an American ideal. His parents had been enslaved, and he grew up poor in West Virginia. As a teenager, he spent his days working in a coal mine and his nights studying, so that he was able to enroll in high school at the age of 20. He received his diploma in 2 years, became a school teacher, then a school principal within 5 years, and then went on to receive his bachelor's degree. He eventually went on to become the second African American, after W.E.B. Du Bois, to receive a doctorate from Harvard University. Woodson grew to be almost as controversial as he was accomplished. He fought with some elites in the African-American community, including the leadership of Howard University and the NAACP. Much of the time, those leaders believed he was pushing too hard, moving too fast. Many of them thought about what he called Negro History Week, that it was something too much, too quickly. As they saw it, black people in America needed to work at blending in to quietly prove themselves worthy of their rights, and above all, not to upset white elites. They were among the first to state what has more recently become a mantra among the anti-diversity crowd. Why have black history? Aren't we all Americans? Shouldn't it just be American history? Woodson argued that for any people to command respect, there had to be respect for their history. In 1920s America, with the Ku Klux Klan growing and black voting rights shrinking, it was clear that African Americans were already treated as a special group. Woodson was demanding attention to black history to get more respect and to make that group, in fact, really special. At the same time, he foresaw new possibilities in the future. He looked forward to a time when African American history would be so integral to our understanding of the nation's past that a month devoted to black history would be unnecessary, if not redundant. Our awareness of African American history has transformed dramatically since 1926, and Barack Obama did get reelected. Still, I'm not convinced that we're yet to the point that Carter Woodson had imagined. There's plenty of work to be done, and yet I still can't wait for Black History Month to end. I'm Spencer Downing with The Week in History.
When we come back, can worker-owned cooperatives transform workers' lives and livelihoods? Stay tuned.
Thank you.
This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Can worker-owned cooperatives transform workers' lives and livelihoods? With us is Jessica Gordon-Nembhardt. Jessica Gordon-Nembhardt is a professor of community justice and social economic development at the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College at the City University of New York. She's director of the McNair Post-Baccalaureate Achievement Program. Her latest book is Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Jessica Gordon-Nembhardt. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you very much.
Very excited about your work, your study of cooperatives, cooperative economies, and history within the United States in particular. I thought we should start with somebody that you cited, which was W.E.B. Du Bois' theory. Could you give us an idea of what that theory is exactly?
I'm actually still struggling with how best to talk about it. But basically, Du Bois argued that because African Americans were more than just marginalized, but were sort of the lowest of the low on the economic totem pole, were pretty much left out of mainstream economics, were discriminated against in all the markets, we needed to do something a little different. And that is to kind of turn inward a little bit, use what he called voluntary segregation, or what most of us talk about as solidarity economics, or even black nationalism, in terms of looking into the group itself and creating a group economy based on cooperative economics that would really make sure to deliver all the goods and services and deliver the kind of economy that would help make the whole black community prosperous and that would get us out of the oppressive system that we were in. He's got lots of great quotes, but one is about how we can use intelligent economic cooperation to enter the new city as men and women and not mules, meaning. And the new city for him was, this is at the turn of the century, he's talking about how industrialization is really going to take off and new forms of industrialization are going to be the way to prosperity and that African Americans can use cooperative ownership and cooperative democratic forms of economics to actually propel us in a position to be on equal, if not to exceed what the mainstream U.S. capitalist economy is doing. And stop being the mules of the economy and the mules of the society and actually be the intellectual economic leaders. So it's kind of very exciting. He has another quote about being at the forefront of industrial development and even another quote about how co-ops are going to help us to insulate ourselves and isolate and insulate ourselves and form a strong economic phalanx of prosperity and economic stability, so that we can't be harmed by these other forces. So it's an interesting notion about how a group of people with a common interest, in this case, class and race, can come together and use democratic cooperative economics to both our economic needs, but also to help propel us into a new and better economic system that would really help everybody.
One of the things that I find most compelling about cooperative economics is the idea of democratic workplace and the idea that it's participatory, where people actually get to make decisions together, one person, one vote, and then they share in the proceeds of it so that it's more egalitarian than a standard corporate model.
Absolutely.
So can you give us a little bit of background in terms of how these have actually worked? I'm mostly interested in the worker-owned co-ops, but I know you've studied many different forms of cooperatives. Can you kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of how these, in a practical way, work?
Even though I've been studying all different kinds of cooperative ownership, I've focused on worker co-ops whenever I could because I really think that they're one of our most important structures and one of the best ways, as you say, to democratize capital and to really have widespread economic participation and ownership and real democracy in our economic relations. So I have studied particularly late 20th century and 21st century worker-owned co-ops, often among people of color, but not always among people of color. And I even have done some work specifically about women of color, particularly black women in worker co-ops. And what we're finding is that worker co-ops, especially the ones that have actually been part of social mission and a social enterprise, model, which would be ones like cooperative home care associates in the South Bronx of New York City, or Mandela Food Co-op in, I think it's Western Oakland in California, or some of the sewing co-ops that have been in the South. There were two in North Carolina. There's one right now, I think that's also in North Carolina, also Opportunity Threads. There's some catering co-ops. Oh, and child care co-ops. So there's Child Space in Philadelphia and a few other child care co-ops and babysitting co-ops. What we're finding with these worker co-ops is that they're able to take often very low-wage jobs that we wouldn't consider good. Like when we talk about a good job, right, we mean it pretty much has a living wage. You have benefits like vacation time, sick leave, sometimes retirement benefits. You also have the ability to move up in the job, so job ladder success. So these worker co-ops have been able to take industries and businesses that normally don't do that, like home care normally doesn't even give its employees full-time work because, you know, often they're just piecing together. You might be working for an elderly couple 5 hours a day, three or four times a week, but that's not really full-time work. It doesn't usually pay a living wage. It has no benefits, etc. So Cooperative Home Care Associates, for example, has taken that work and done two things at the same time. The first thing is they've raised the quality of the job, but partly they've done that by raising the quality of the work. So they also have an arm that does specified training so that all of their worker owners go through the same high-quality training so they can make sure that they're giving the kind of quality work that deserves the kind of quality pay and benefits and things that they want. They're also able to piece together full-time work for women, even if it ends up that they have to work in two different people's homes. But they pull together the work so that women have full-time jobs. They also pay living wages. The members get retirement funds. They are able to give back dividends because they're a profitable business. So, and most worker co-ops are for profit, so that they actually have profits or surplus at the end that can then be divided between going back into the business and being given back to the members as dividends. So some years the women have made 25% of their initial investment in the company back in 1 year, so that they have an investment, an asset, as well as a really good job, as well as high-level training, and then they also have ability to move up in the organization. They can move from the lowest level of home care to get higher credentials in nursing. They can move over into the training arm of the company. They can move up into the management part of the company. Sort of like the old days, they can sort of stay in the business almost forever or for a long period of time because they don't get stuck in the lowest wage job or that kind of thing. And the other thing that Chaka in particular was able to do was they actually lobbied the state and city government to reallocate Medicare money to pay for home care, which was one of the ways to up the wages for the whole industry so that when they had their living wages, they were more competitive in the industry. And we see that with some of the other groups, though not quite as successfully. Say the same thing in child care, right? Raising the quality of child care work because the women own their own company. They pay attention to high-quality training. They're paid a living wage. They work well with the parents. They own part of the company, so if there are profits and surplus, they can get that back as extra, you know, return on their investment. They develop leadership skills, and so they assert themselves more in their own families, in their own communities, even on the job. A lot of these worker-owned companies are also unionized, and the union really either or both helps them to provide some of the benefits like health benefits and things, and also helps them to remember that they're owners and workers. And so how do they pay attention to the issues as workers? The union helps them do that, and then the board meetings and other parts of the company help to remind them that they're owners and that they can make other kinds of decisions also. And so it's an interesting collaboration. As you sort of said, it's kind of the best of both worlds. I believe it's a way to both raise the dignity of work as well as build assets. And then I really think the leadership development and the other social skills and social capital that gets developed is almost just as important as the finance capital they're able to gain.
If we contrast and actually fit this into larger economic questions and larger economic structures, one of the things I've been thinking about is that we've seen the world move into this sort of neoliberal age where increasingly the labor is contracted out, wages have been forced down because there's a competition for them.
Unions have been busted.
And so there's been, on one side, this move towards this competitive environment versus the co-op. But I wonder, in the shape of a neoliberal economy, which seems to be nearly global at this stage, how do these fit in? Are they proliferating? Can they become entire communities of cooperatives that work together? Or are they eventually going to get drowned out by a neoliberal economy?
The first thing let me just put on the table is, while we're definitely seeing this deunionization and kind of a modifying of work and making work worse, but also having less people have even access to jobs. So that's one movement and theme that's happening in this neoliberal world. There also is a movement in the multinationals and a lot of the corporations that are actually democratizing their workplaces more because they're realizing that they're more productive. They can get higher rates of production out of employees who actually are given more responsibility, respect, and ability to work together. So there's a lot more of these quality circles and labor management boards and things. And a lot of the most profitable multinational companies actually practice a somewhat of workplace democracy. The problem is they don't go far enough, right? So it's a weird thing. In some ways, capitalism is still thriving because it has appropriated some of the best practices of having workers have a say and work together and that kind of thing. And yet at the same time, they're able to use that to oppress workers more, and especially in places like the U.S., reduce jobs and the quality of jobs. So it's a really weird or interesting, whichever way you want to look at it, tension. And I don't know exactly what we should do about that, except to say that I think in some ways I'm hopeful that even the neoliberal companies are in some ways moving more towards some other things. But the other thing that makes me hopeful, which is the second way I wanted to answer that, is to think about the move toward privatization and the ways that the co-op movement in Emilia-Romagna and Italy have handled that. And even though in the Emilia-Romagna region they've been privatizing and downsizing and things like that, the response, because they're from a very, I guess, liberal, progressive co-op region, has been to privatize toward cooperatives, right? In fact, worker co-ops, in fact, what we call social co-ops. And I'm very excited by that movement, and I do think that that kind of a movement can grow and should grow and will grow in the United States. So the social co-ops are worker-owned co-ops that provide social services in some way. So you could count teachers, but often it's counselors, psychologists, child care providers, drug rehabilitation workers, people in all those kinds of social services. And as the government started to privatize those services, instead of providing them through municipalities and government-owned agencies, the privatization, a lot of it happened as co-op development. They have laws now that actually encourage social service workers to join, create their own worker co-ops, and they can still tap into the public money in the sense that if you have somebody who's on disability, their public money can go to pay for you to service them as a disabled and to help work with them. So there's a growing group of small to medium-sized social cooperatives that are really doing a lot of the work that we originally thought the welfare state should do. And so, of course, no one's happy that the welfare state is not doing it, but at least if they're not doing it, having co-ops do it and worker co-ops do it seems to be a good compromise or a good solution. And it seems like these worker co-ops are growing. The other thing that's really exciting for the Italian model is that they also have another level of worker co-op, which is what they call Type B. And that's where the social service worker, as part of the therapy for the mentally challenged, for the disabled, for the recovering addicts, they actually help some of their clients to create worker co-ops as part of the therapy and part of the ways to help them. So recovering addicts and returning citizens might be doing landscaping or tutoring or other kinds of small businesses that they're also owning as worker co-ops. So we have a nice system there with a lot of interlocking different kinds of worker co-op addressing a lot of the issues in society. So that's the social co-op kind of notion. And it seems like in the U.S., we don't have those laws, but we are moving toward more and more worker co-ops in some of those areas. And the final way I would answer it is I also think that one of the ways we have to approach this growing neoliberalism is to actually bring industry and manufacturing back to the U.S. And again, one of the ways we can do that is through worker co-ops. Because we have seen, in fact, the United Steelworkers are working on this with the Mondragon, which is the other great worker co-op example in northern Spain, and they're trying to create more worker co-ops in industrial world, especially like with alternative energy, solar energy, recycling, I'm trying to think of what some of the other examples are. And so again, using the co-ops to solve sort of social problems, but also to help re-employ or employ people and to bring back those high-quality jobs, I think, are the major ways that we're able to fight this neoliberalism. And in some ways, we're under the radar. So I'm hoping that we can get a critical mass of these kinds of co-ops established in the U.S. before anyone decides that it's a problem and tries to attack it full force. But I may be too Pollyanna-ish on that one.
You mentioned in one of your articles about plans that had been put forward in Jackson, Mississippi by the mayor Lumumba to create an entire cooperative economy. Can you describe how he saw that there? And then can you connect it also to maybe what happened in Detroit? Mike, our engineer, and I were talking about Detroit before we got you on the line. Can you contrast what his vision was with what has happened there and then in Detroit?
When Mayor Lumumba got elected, one of his platforms was to really change the economy so that everybody could work, but also the economy would be doing things that would help the community and solve community problems. And also, I think the mayors before him had started to privatize a lot of things like the waste management and the recycling and that kind of thing. So one idea he had was that he could do what the Italians did instead of just having them go to private, for-profit, sole proprietor companies. These services could be given or earned by worker co-ops that would be doing the recycling, doing the waste management, that kind of thing. So he had this idea of sort of taking back a lot of those privatized businesses, taking them back for communities so that they'd be worker-owned companies. And then he also wanted to help promote more worker ownership in general around Jackson, both to solve the unemployment, also to solve the low pay issue, and to kind of create a more sustainable and stable, prosperous economy for Jackson. I guess he has, is it three prongs? I'm not sure I have the right number, but anyway, probably three prongs. The first prong was actually education, so that 2014 Jackson Rising Conference was all about education. Its original plan was to educate about 5,000 Mississippians about what is a cooperative, how to start one, et cetera. So it was supposed to be a sort of massive training program that could then launch a whole citywide co-op incubation project and then to continue to do co-op education and co-op incubation so that, again, these kinds of businesses that I just talked about could be formed and you would have people who understood how to do it. So the first prong was education. The second prong was this identifying the industries and sometimes even firms that could be transitioned into worker co-ops. So, again, looking at the companies that had just been privatized that used to be city-owned, looking at businesses where the owner was ready to retire and had no one to turn the business over to, so thinking about succession plan and turning those over to their, and selling the business to the employees, that kind of thing. So that second prong was to figure out what businesses would be good to go into, either new businesses or these municipal service businesses or these succession businesses. And I guess the third piece was just his, you know, political platform, to have enough of a groundswell of people who were supporting him so that you had people who wanted to do the training who were petitioning their city council members or aldermen, I can't remember what they're called in Jackson, and making sure that there was that public pressure, right, to keep doing this, that the rest of the city council saw that people really wanted this kind of economic change and these kind of economic things. So the real kickoff was supposed to be this Jackson Rising Conference, which still happened even though he was dead by the time they put it on. And then that Jackson Rising would launch the rest of this program. And then the hope was that there would be at least the recycling co-op, I guess, that would be sort of the first of many that would take off. So a lot of momentum was lost because Lumumba died, but the conference did happen. Now, it didn't have 5,000 people, but it had about 600 people, which I think we all can fairly say was the largest cooperative conference of predominantly African Americans, maybe since the Young Negroes Cooperative League's first conference in 1930 or something. So significant conference, even though it didn't live up to its original plan. And Cooperation Jackson is the name of the group of some of Lumumba's followers and supporters who then regrouped themselves outside of the city government and now are doing urban farming. They're still trying to do the recycling co-op. They have a building called the Lumumba Community Center where they are doing education and have a co-op cafe. And I think they have one other project underway. It's gone much slower than they expected, but they're still, you know, they're still trudging along and moving along. The connections with Detroit are the two cities probably have very similar issues. Detroit probably even worse than Jackson in terms of industries have basically left. Lots of people who actually were relatively skilled because they had worked in some skilled industries but now have no work at all. A lot of vacant properties. So Detroit, my understanding is, has a lot of informal urban farming going on and stuff. Lots of opportunity to kind of think about how to re-industrialize the city, particularly starting with small worker co-ops and moving out from there. I went to Detroit once or twice to talk to some of the food security movements and some of the co-op development centers there, and they're trying to connect to the urban farming and use the local produce that's coming out of the urban farming and then do co-op restaurants or community-owned restaurants. I've seen some groups also trying to get back the industrial centers, so that these, what's it called, make-it centers, where young people and other people can share equipment to actually make things. One of my groups, the Solidarity Economy Network, the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, is actually having a conference with our Canadian partners. We're doing a sort of North American Solidarity Economy Summit in Detroit in April, and we're trying to highlight the things that are happening in Detroit, but also talk about the issues of deindustrialization, racism, et cetera, and how the solidarity economy, which is sort of co-ops and broader non-exploitative economic relationships, how we can push those forward in a city like Detroit.
In terms of externalities is what they call them, where these massive corporations are generally forcing the cost of environmental cleanup or environmental damage or damage to the community or damage to human rights onto the rest of the world so that they don't have to pay, therefore take more profit. Has there been studies that show the contrast between that unsustainable behavior in that case with what cooperatives generally do?
Some of us are looking for research on that, and there's not a lot yet. There was one study in Canada which was a little bit discouraging because it said that co-ops aren't any more ecological than any other business. But a lot of us have been arguing that because co-ops are so local-based, and owned by local community members who live and work in the same place, that just for that reason they're a little bit more ecologically minded, because they have to live in the same place that they work, and if their workplace is polluting it, they're not going to be happy with that. And also a lot of the newly emerging markets for co-ops are in sustainable energy and recycling and clean up things and stuff. So in some ways, the intuitiveness is that co-ops are much more about ecological sustainability and ecological transformation. We don't know yet because there aren't enough studies to really tell us what's going on, but we do know that those are a lot of the areas that co-ops are emerging in to address those issues and to do those industries. So I don't know exactly how to answer your question, except I think the promising growth is to see so many co-ops, particularly worker co-ops, going into solar energy and alternative energy, to be doing a variety of recycling things, to be doing waste management. There's a new really exciting worker co-op in Boston called Cero, C-E-R-O, that I think they're doing something in waste management and recycling, and mostly working with low-income people of color in Boston. And they were able to buy trucks and things like that. There's, as I said, the waste management project in Jackson, Mississippi. There's a new co-op starting in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is right outside of Washington, D.C. They're trying to solve the water runoff problem, where, you know, toxic water is going into the drains and back into the water system and into the rivers and that kind of thing. And they're using a worker co-op model for that. Those are the two areas where we're seeing the largest growth in worker co-ops, at least in the U.S., in the social services and in the ecological recycling. So if that's true, then even if we can't prove that co-ops in general or the old-style co-ops are more ecological, we certainly know that the growth in the worker co-op movement, one of the areas, is that area. And it's very promising because we're solving, again, community problems at the same time that you're providing decent work and democratizing the economic structures and employment.
There seems to be from my reading, a growth in the number of cooperatives. Do you think that is validated by real numbers when you do a larger look?
It's a little of both. What I would say is this. The co-op movement in general is actually constricting in some areas and growing in others. So there's definitely a constriction in some of the agricultural co-ops and some of the old co-ops, like the big granaries and things like that in Canada and the U.S. They've definitely been demutualizing. And even the credit union, there's fewer in number, though there seem to be more members, even though there's fewer credit unions. But part of that is because the regulators have been forcing credit unions to close, so that's a whole other issue. But at the same time, certainly there's a market growth in worker co-ops and food co-ops. And I think because worker co-ops and food co-ops are innovative ways to solve immediate local economic problems. Also, we've been in pretty terrible economic times. You know, we had the greatest recession since the Great Depression, that kind of thing. So I think we're seeing that, at least on a more grassroots local level, the issues about food security and issues about creating better jobs, at least, as I said, in the social co-ops and the ecology, seem to be really important. Worker co-ops are particularly growing among urban immigrant communities, often because they can't find other work, and so they're finding that working together solves a lot of things. We're seeing, as I said, industries that seem to be needed in the local community are being created by people who want to work together in co-ops, so those are the ecological ones. We're also seeing not just consumer food co-ops, but also food services. Right, so the bakeries of the Arizmendi Group in the Bay Area are really, I guess what, they're up to six now, catering co-ops, even small-level ones, and then some co-op restaurants and things seem to be jumping up in New York City, Boston, some other areas. So I think we have to really start to disaggregate the co-op world when we've been talking about what's happening with co-ops, because it's very different when you look at some of the older, more established co-ops, and then when you look at these younger, new model, smaller, more grassroots co-ops. And the growth is really in these younger, smaller, grassroots, worker-owned co-ops, as I said, that are really looking to solve a variety of problems and are being either created by people themselves who are coming together to do the work or by nonprofits and other community organizations that are really doing social entrepreneurship and social mission co-ops. That seems to be, I think, where the growth is. And I would say rightly so, because that's really where the needs are. So for me, it's exciting to see that co-ops are continuing to do what they've always, identify needs and solve economic and social problems. And I see co-ops doing that in the U.S., so I'd like to see more, but at least they're doing it.
Jessica Gordon-Nembhard, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Gordon-Nembhard is a professor of community justice and social economic development at the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College of the City University of New York. She's director of the McNair Post-Baccalaureate Achievement Program. Her latest book is Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Although governments rarely apologize for crimes committed against humanity or other injustices that they have perpetrated, says our next guest, sometimes they do, such as in the cases of France and Germany for their crimes during World War II. But many others go unacknowledged by the perpetrating countries. Japan, for example, has yet to make an unambiguous apology to its victims. And Turkey has refused to acknowledge the genocide it perpetrated against the Armenians, much less apologize. But our next guest suggests that official apologies are meaningful. They help to change the terms and meanings of national membership. We're joined now by Melissa Nobles. She is a professor of political science at MIT. She's the author of two books. One is called Shades of Citizenship, Race and the Census in Modern Politics, and the new one, Politics of Official Apologies. Welcome to The Insiders, Melissa Nobles.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you with us. So you argue that countries like Japan and others who have not apologized for their crimes against humanity or other perpetrations are really facing some strained relations as a result, but that countries rarely do these things. So how do we reconcile this?
Right. Well, in the cases of Japan and others, it's generally two types of apologies. One are those international apologies, so Japan for the crimes committed during World War II, and then others to their own citizenry. And typically, international apologies come about largely for geopolitical reasons, which is you apologize because you want to get along better in the world system, and it's frowned upon if you've committed. There's an expectation, at least among certain other countries, that you should apologize. So, in other words, diplomatic pressure can be brought to bear. Even though Japan has apologized unambiguously, it has made several attempts, at least beginning since the 1990s, to apologize for World War II crimes. But as scholars of Japan have documented, there's a tremendous amount of contestation within Japan among right-wing nationalists and others who don't think that Japan should apologize. So typically apologies raise all kinds of issues within domestic politics because there are going to be people who think that apology is undeserved and others who think that it is deserved. And the conflict is over how we interpret history and its moral obligation.
Now, you listed some 72 apologies.
Correct.
Half of these were related to World War II.
Correct.
So since then, or even before then, there have not been very many acknowledgments about the atrocities that have been perpetrated by governments.
That's true. And we might think about it as, in certain ways, apologies, at least in the 20th century, in the latter half of the 20th century, is representing the rise of an international human rights regime. That is a growing understanding that human rights matter, people pressing for apologies, and such. Prior to that, while we know that there's been all kinds of atrocities throughout human history, if there hasn't been any pressure brought to bear on governments to apologize, it was typically seen as the unhappy results of history, no matter how horrible the atrocities, right? That's just the way history goes. But in the 20th century, we've seen a different view about that, in that maybe there should be some moral reckoning brought to bear, and perhaps it could be brought by either the direct victims in certain cases or their descendants in others.
Now, you argue that these are actually more meaningful than other symbolic gestures, that actual apologies hold more weight.
Yes, I do. And it's kind of counterintuitive in a way, and I know a lot of people say, oh, what's an apology? It's just empty talk and such. But typically what an apology can do is that it sets the terms for discussion about what next. So in other words, if you're willing to, a big part of not wanting to think about the past is because it's just a flat denial of it, right? We don't want to acknowledge, as I imagine we talked about earlier about Turkey not wanting to acknowledge the Armenian genocide, in part because when you acknowledge something, then questions follow, which is, well, now that you've acknowledged it, what are you going to do to rectify it? So in that way, an apology sets the terms for another discussion about what is to come next. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a discussion about reparations, for example. When people think about if America apologizes for slavery, to just use one example, well, that means that we're going to have to pay reparations. Not necessarily, but it will mean that we can have a discussion about what else might we do to think about rectifying slavery's legacy, such as Jim Crow's legacy. So it gives citizens a way of anchoring their concerns about the present with the legacy of the past and making history an important part of that discussion.
You mentioned the Turkish government, and you actually open your book calling the denial or lack of apology from the Turkish government to be the most notorious. Why did you call it the most notorious?
Yeah, I don't know that that was hyperbolic, but it's certainly, at least in the late 20th century now, it's getting a lot of attention. It continues to be one that people are focusing on, in part because of Turkey's insistence not to apologize. And as you well know, there's robust debate among historians about the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the creation of Turkey and what happened to Armenians. But the adjective notorious, I think, is partly because of the ways in which the issue seems so polarized. And with the exception of a growing number of Turkish historians within Turkey proper who apparently, are not well received, at least by the Turkish government, will lead one to suggest that there's not, that the revisiting of this issue is going to take a bit longer, and that Armenians will continue to have to press for an apology and hopefully garner some support from other groups around the world.
Now, in some cases, there have been some cases where the apology has been very meaningful. I think the one that you mentioned was Germany having to apologize for the Holocaust and has, to the tune of about $100 billion, made payments to survivors, to Israel, to other victims. But that's really rare. So
yeah.
Even if some country like Turkey, like Japan, like Australia, you mentioned Australia for its treatment of its indigenous people, it's rare that that actually comes to fruition.
Yes, it is. In the end, if you think about the grand scheme of things, it is rare that governments do it. Most of the cases that I've talked about, of the ones that you're mentioning, with the exception of Germany, the rare cases are those where a government apologizes to its own citizenry. It's more common for there to be apologies between governments, and as I said earlier, that largely has to do with the dynamics of international politics. But when you think about a government having to apologize to its own citizenry, it is quite rare, and it comes about mostly, there has to be two people who want this to happen, two groups of actors, the aggrieved group themselves and political elites. And if the political elite are not interested in it, that is, they're not willing to push it, they're not willing to be responsive to demands that are being made towards them, then there won't be an apology. So that you have to get political elites interested, and the question is, how do you do that? How is it in their political interest? And that is the stuff of politics.
So how important is it, do you think, for aggrieved victims to pursue these kinds of apologies?
Right. Well, I think it's important. it's not the only tactic that one could have. And I know there's a big, you know, there's oftentimes discussions whether if a group has, organized groups have lots of ways in which they can expend their energies, both monetary energies as well as their physical energies. And where do you spend your political capital? And should we spend it at telling a government, apologize for the past? Well, typically the only time that's used is for at least in the cases of Indigenous people where it's been successful in Canada and now Australia, is that that many claims for the present, that is land claims, getting the government to recognize the harm that was done over centuries, rests finally in an open acknowledgement of history, not a piecemeal, not, you know, something off the side, but a public discussion of history. And apologies are one of the most direct and effective ways of getting a discussion about history going, right? One that simply says, let's look at the historical record, let's look at the full historical record, and let's make a moral judgment about it, right? Let's finally say that wasn't a good thing and it's had deleterious consequences. And for groups who think that history is really important in anchoring their current day claims are going to look for apologies. If one thinks that we just ought to demand better treatment simply because we're citizens and it has nothing to do with our past, I mean, we know what happened to us, but we're not going to make that the focus of our political strategy. Instead, we're going to say we demand change because we are citizens and we're starting from right now, then you would think that apologies aren't important to your strategy. So in the end, for an aggrieved group, there has to be some kind of discussion about where history fits in thinking about a strategy moving forward.
Melissa Nobles, this is quite profound. I really want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Melissa Nobles is a professor at MIT. She's the author of The Politics of Official Apologies. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.